Welcome to the Evidence Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, John Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this August the 5th on the West Coast, now August the 6th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. I'd like to welcome all those listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network tonight. Why? Well, because we appreciate you listening in, and we know many of you are listening in because of tonight's guest. I'm going to not waste any time and bring him straight on board. He hosts his own show on Wind Talkers Radio Network and blogtalkradio.com. He's my regular Thursday night guest here on Evident Footprints. His show is called A Marine's Disquisition, former U.S. Marine from 1967 through 1977. My good friend Drew Malone Raines III. Drew, welcome to the show.
Well, it's, you know, he hasn't got much to say when he wants to bring me on first.
Oh, no, I want you involved.
I heard that.
We're going to have a discussion tonight.
Now, disquisition, please.
Well, and a disquisition. How's
and
that?
A disquisition. And for all my Marines around the world, Semper Fi. We're going after them 2x2 and 4x4 and 8x8. Remember, guys. Just because you ain't rich, that doesn't mean the rich aren't having trouble, like those $35 million homes in Santa Monica, California, that are being foreclosed on tomorrow.
Yeah, I heard about that. That's kind of interesting. Tell us something about that. Why are they
foreclosed? Most people think it's only the poor people out there that are having a tough time, but there are $1 million homes in California being foreclosed. 35 of them are going to be done tomorrow in a massive upper-tier foreclosure where the sheriff is on the way out there to, if the people haven't already left the house, he's going to make sure they've left the house, the estate.
Now, is this through one bank or do you know any of the particulars?
It's not one bank. It's one law firm.
Hmm.
It's doing the foreclosure for several banks.
I see.
They've been holding off and, hoping that, it's like, they're doing these non-judicial foreclosures going and coming across America.
Mm-hmm.
And, you find these, it's kind of hard to believe, okay, there's $1 million homes. The most expensive one is a $2.2 million home in Beverly Hills that's underwater, and they've been attempting to work with these millionaires for several months, and now the millionaires have run out of time. It's interesting to note that some high-priced areas around the country, people do at times buy with cash. But it's not uncommon for many of the wealthy people, individual, to purchase $1 million home and have some kind of a hefty mortgage on it later on. And these hefty mortgages later on are basically, they try to save their small business. Okay, maybe it's a motorcycle distribution center for Harley Davidson or Honda, or maybe it's a fast food chain,
mm-hmm,
of 8 or 9, maybe 10 hamburger joints. So they've got these hefty mortgages on their $1 million estates, and their businesses are barely able to stay above water, but not give them enough money to make their mortgage payment.
Yeah, I
so
see.
That's how they've come about losing these places. And some of these men and women, it's not just a male problem. It's a family problem. And some of these men and women, they would, excuse me, they just go ahead and lose their estate and hold on to their business.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're looking at their businesses. In one instance that I looked up, one guy owns 15 jack-in-the-boxes. But he's got a $1.3 million estate that's being foreclosed on. His jack-in-the-boxes, you would think, were making him enough money to pay his mortgage, but he fell short. And then he hadn't made payments on it for the last 18 months.
Hmm.
So just because it says, you know, somebody tells you they own 15 jack-in-the-boxes, that doesn't mean that they're making money out of it. He's barely able to pay the mortgage on the 15 jack-in-the-boxes. But is he ready to give up his home that he lives in that he's overbought, or is he willing to give up his businesses that'll carry him out 10 years from now? So the millionaires are losing their places because they're not getting the profit margin that they need, i.e. the volume of food, if it happens to be a jack-in-the-box, or maybe it's a motorcycle shop, and they're getting enough to pay the bills and keep people at work. But you stop and look at some of this, Don, and you've got a guy hypothetically, and this is hypothetically. This is not to come down on anybody that happens to be in this circumstance. So please, I did not look into anybody's private lives today to come up with them, to specifically pick on any one individual. If it happens to sound like one individual in California, please forgive me, ladies and gentlemen. It's not intended to pick on any one specific family or individual.
Well, there could be millions that fit the category you're going to
describe. There's thousands of men and millionaires out there across America that this category could really fit. In one hypothetical situation that plays pretty close, I'm going to scale it down a little bit. But the gentleman has a motorcycle shop, and he's got that's a franchise, and he's got 22 employees. Well, is he going to give up his $1.5 million home, or is he going to keep 22 people at work? You know, he can save his home by getting rid of his motorcycle shop. But if he gets rid of his motorcycle shop, he puts 22 people out of business or out of work. Which way do you go when you're a moral American and you really care? So you have to give the guy a lot of respect in as much as he's keeping his motorcycle shop and 22 employees working versus trying to hold on to a $1.5 million home that he overbought in the first place. So there are millionaires out there that are having a tough time. There are movie stars. Many of you heard Nicolas Cage. He's lost a $22 million estate in Las Vegas, a $34 million estate in New Orleans, another $12 million estate in New York City. So and when I say estate, ladies and gentlemen, that doesn't necessarily mean it's a house with 40 acres or 50 acres. When I say estate, like in New York City, it's the penthouse that he lost. And I don't mind picking on Nicholas, because Nicholas already has admitted what these places were. And I couldn't understand why in the world he would have such an exorbitant home in New Orleans. But then I started looking around, and there's several movie stars that have bought some million-dollar properties, multi-million-dollar properties in the New Orleans Metroplex. And it amazes me that properties in the New Orleans Metroplex are going for that much, but then after Katrina. But then these places that these guys are buying are in the high areas on St. Charles. And that's out by Tulane, for those of you that have never been to New Orleans. And we're talking about an area of New Orleans where the trees line St. Charles Boulevard, and these trees have been there for 250 years.
Yeah.
And there's a tram that runs down the center, going both ways, all the way out to the university and back into town. It's the old-fashioned, just laid back. And these are, some of these homes were built in the late 1800s, and there's eight or nine that were built back in the 1840s. So this is the old aristocratic area of New Orleans. I didn't realize that they were going for over $10 million, but they do. And that says a lot about what's happened to America. We've just put property and houses above ourselves, and the greed and the I'm better than Mr. Jones, or I'm better than Mr. Smith, instead of helping each other out. It's like, I grow fruits and vegetables, but if my friend down the street's who hasn't got the ability to grow fruits and vegetables, he's going to pay me what I sell fruits and vegetables for at the restaurant. He's going to pay me the same price the restaurant pays me. Well, that doesn't make sense. Here's a family man that would like to have some fresh fruits and vegetables, but he can't afford $20 for 4 pounds of zucchini and 5 pounds of mushrooms and 2 pounds of okra and maybe 2 pounds of tomatoes. Well, that might be the going price at a high dollar restaurant, but for the man down the street that's your friend, you know, $20 is a hefty amount of money. You might sell it to him once, but I guarantee you'll never sell it to him again when that man could go down and buy GMO food and get 5 times more for $5. Now, that's what America has turned to. We, instead of trying to help thy neighbor, it's help thy neighbor is got the money to meet the greed.
Yeah. Well, Drew, this is all due to the massive amount of privatization of previously public-owned lands and public infrastructure.
Exactly.
And this is
the massive amount of turnover of the small individual farmers into big corporate farms. And you can't live on corporate farms. You can't. The corporate farms are destroying America.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've talked about this on a lot of other shows. There are a couple other topics that I want to cover, but not to run away from this. Let me say that it reeks of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, if you remember what happened about a year ago. And we announced, we warned that was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of missing money from that whole project, which is nothing but another government bureaucracy, and from the days of Henry Cisneros during the Clinton administration, it's been corrupt, and it ties in with Countrywide and a slew of other financial bodies that went belly up and then were bailed out, with the money being sent to foreign countries or alleged to have been sent to foreign countries and secreted away somewhere. So they're trying to revive this market, and those properties that you're describing, they refer to those as prime property crises, or there are realtors that specialize in unloading those properties.
Oh yeah,
it's a market in and of itself.
Exactly, and people look, they see the pictures of these houses that are in the $1 million range, just the $1 million range. We're talking about $1 million. And a lot of people that are in alternative radio, they're sitting out there with their 1,100 square foot home, 1,500 square foot home, 2,000 square foot home in the country, XYZ County or XYZ Parish, Louisiana. And they can't fathom an 1,100 square foot home being sold for $990,000,
yeah.
And it's a lot that's no more than 100 feet wide by 120 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's going on right now with one specific house in on Santa Monica Boulevard. when it was originally sold back in 1933, the house was only somewhere in the neighborhood of about $4,000.
Mm-hmm.
It was built, you know, and then in 1953, it sells for $600,000.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. 20 years ago, I saw a 900 square foot house that was being sold for $250,000 not even in the most desirable area. It had a gravel driveway. It was outside of Los Angeles. It had a gravel driveway. The grass was virtually burnt out to a crisp from the sun and from not having been taken care of. There were two or three shrubs that were totally withered, and the inside of the house looked like a sleazy motel. It was incredible, and I told the realtor, "Good luck, good luck. Somebody will come along that sees some purpose for investing that much money in this." But it looks like a hell.
And people think, "Well, who buys a house like this? You know, these little 900, 1,200 square foot home that's got a monthly house payment." Of $4,000 a month. $4,000 a month house payment? They make $20,000 a month in salary. $20,000 a month in salary, if you sound like those of us in alternative radio, $20,000, shucks, ladies and gentlemen, $20,000, I can live for a couple of years on, well, I can live for 5 years on $20,000. But this is the monthly income of some of these people in California, and you think $20,000 a month. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's only $250,000 a year. There's a lot of high tech jobs in and around Santa Monica that start off at $180,000. That's start off pay right out of college. And these corporations pay these guys $180,000, and they're looking for a place to live close. So that's how these houses get up there. But this is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, why do you want to go to a ball game when the ticket costs $500?
Or $2,500.
Or $2,500.
There are places.
Yeah.
Yankee Stadium is such a place. You know, they built.
How about the basketball team? What's what they call that? The NBA Finals?
Mm-hmm.
The ticket price on the ticket said $200, but you couldn't find a ticket for less than $5,000.
Yeah, it's crazy. Round trip airfare from the States to South Africa for the
World Cup basketball, you know, football game,
$7,000 round trip airfare. We're just talking about airfare. it's crazy. Oh well,
for $7,000 you can go buy yourself a good quality 56-inch flat screen television mounted on the wall, a good quality surround sound speaker system. A nice quality leather chair, and camp out and think you're in the stadium and have a better picture of what's going on, because you don't need to be looking through magnifying glasses 200 yards up into the stadium.
Or binoculars, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah, binoculars.
Or a telescope.
I was talking to one of my buddies who. Went to the Super Bowl. He didn't go there to participate. He went there to work as security. And the area that he worked in was on the last row end zone.
Mm-hmm.
In the top row at the in the end zone. And he said, when the teams were playing at the other end zone, you need a spotting scope to see where the ball was. And I'm saying, you got to be kidding. He says, you know, Drew, if I hadn't been working the stadium for security, there's no way on God's earth I would have paid $1,500 for a ticket. And I said, what do you mean, $1,500? That's what most of these people paid up here, $1,500 a ticket to sit in the last row in the stadium. And you couldn't, all you could see was a bunch of dots down there running around on the turf. I'm not going to pay $1,500 in the last row to watch a ball game.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, that's what's happening to the economy all over the place. Idol worship and these outrageous prices to pay people who are paid to divert our attention from what's really going on. I want to talk about something here. This is an
China oil spill. You want to get over to that?
Well, I'm going to get into something else first, which is the root of all of our problems currently. Aside from the corruption that we talk about, it's a different kind of corruption. I was sent an audio clip. It's actually Michael Rivero's What Really Happened show. And he's talking about the issue of the birth certificate and a Supreme Court associate justice, let's say designate, who, by the way, is supposed to take office tomorrow.
Yeah.
So
regurgitation day.
Yeah. So I want to play this clip for you and the listeners. And
how long is it?
Oh, it's not very long. A couple of minutes here. There's a commentary about the appointee, and it ties into another issue.
All right.
And I want to play that. So let's have a listen.
Okay. So we had somebody call in and tell me that we lost our connection when I was still in the middle of the Kagan story. And the part that I was getting to that I mentioned when we dropped off the air is that it turns out, you know, Elena Kagan had no prior experience being a judge or even being a lawyer in a trial courtroom situation. She's been a bureaucrat, and she was the Solicitor General of the United States from March of 2009 until May of this year when she got her nomination. And it turns out, and this may be the reason she got the nomination, she was the Solicitor General during a time when a lot of the lawsuits regarding Obama's birth certificate were coming into the Department of Justice. And in looking through all the dockets, she managed to find herself connected to virtually all of them. Now, I have to tell you, at this point, I don't know what the reality is on this birth certificate situation. I still cannot understand why, if Obama were not actually a citizen, why John McCain and Hillary Clinton would not have used that against him. But that being said, there what is more than likely going on is that there's something else about Obama's birth circumstance that he does not want made public. And that's why there is no original birth certificate. And I don't want to go into it in depth, but there's been an alternative theory that Obama's father is actually a third party not to be named. And if that's what's going on, then that's as far as I want to go with it. Because I really don't care.
Now, I find that kind of interesting. First of all, the position of the Solicitor General was the position that Ted Olson, husband of Barbara Olson, who was allegedly killed in the cruise missile crash into the Pentagon. I meant the flight. She was on an airplane, but it was... It was possibly a cruise missile, certainly internal explosives that caused that building to go. Ted Olson eventually remarried, and Barbara Olson surfaced in Houston, Texas, according to my research. Now, that might just be on paper. That could be just some financial shenanigans going on. There was a report of her having been arrested at the border of Germany and on her way to Poland in 2004. I think it was in October of 2004.
Yeah.
Wearing a red wig, carrying a Vatican passport and $1 million in Italian lira. That was a pretty interesting story. Now, I digress a little bit from Kagan, but that's the same position Ted Olson held that she currently holds as the Solicitor General. Mm-hmm. Ted Olson, remember, was describing numerous cell phone calls that were made from an airplane, from a height or an altitude in which cell phones did not work at the time. So, you know, we got lies from everybody about that event.
Before we go on, we have a Marine here who wants to know, refresh my mind on how many feet there is to a mile.
I don't know if I can refresh your mind. I can refresh your memory.
I don't know about mine. That's just reading what he says.
Yeah. I'm just
I understand.
Answering him literally. 5,280 feet in a mile.
And he comes back in and he says, the last I heard, most airliners fly at 23,000 feet. That appears to be a little over 4 miles. Anywhere in the United States, 4 miles from a cell phone tower, you still can't get reception.
Yeah, and 8,000 feet altitude was at that time the ceiling. That was the maximum altitude you could go in an airplane and get any kind of tower connection, even if you were right over the tower. So the story was obviously bogus. It was intended to cover up the fact that his wife was just ushered somewhere else, and he wasn't about to go into any discussion about it, and it would blow the whole cover of the Pentagon story anyway. That's just one aspect. But that was our Solicitor General in the days of George W. Bush. Now, Kagan, here we have a person being appointed to the Supreme Court. You know, it's very much like the usurper that we have in the White House, who is not even qualified constitutionally to be in that office. And to answer Mr. Rivero's comment about why didn't Hillary and McCain do anything about this, well, if he would read my research, and I would have to say that, you know, he said there's a theory that there's a third party who is the father. What do you mean theory? certainly I proved that the alleged father and mother are not the father and mother. And I've proven that the ruse about Hawaii and Kenya is nothing more than a dialectical argument to get people squabbling between each other. It's obvious. And there are many, many signs that his birth occurred in Indonesia, and the circumstances under which that would have happened were more than coincidental to have been anyone other than Michael Rockefeller. And to put him where he is, again, you know, when you had Clinton, you had a Rockefeller. And you have Hillary Clinton. The reason, answering that question, why those two didn't pitch a fit over this is because Clinton and Obama sponsored a resolution to have McCain declared eligible to run as the president. Why was that, Drew? And you know very well from having read my research that McCain was not born at Coco-Solo Naval Base, nor was he born in Panama in 1936. If I remember the date correctly, they were saying October 29th. And that hospital wasn't built for some 7 to 7.5 years after the fact. Notably because of Executive Order 8986 from Franklin Delano Roosevelt, which requested that the Army Corps of Engineers, working in tandem with the Navy Department, acquired the land to set up the initial boundary to build the hospital. And that edict was issued on December 17, 1941, 5 years and several months after McCain was supposedly born in the hospital that had yet to be built. So they knew McCain was not a citizen. And guess what, Drew? Hillary's not a citizen either, not a natural-born citizen. Okay? So they would have all been basically three rats in a sack fighting over the same principle. Which one's going to squeal on the other? They all got their positions. McCain stepped down, but he got political favors. And so to answer what Mr. Rivero commented on, he barely scraped the surface of this issue. And, you know, well, I'm not going to go there, or I'm not going to care. He's been a proponent of the Hawaii argument from day one. There is no reason, and I'll say this, Drew, you know my feelings on this, but to the listening audience, there's no reason for any agency to hide a document if it's legitimate. There's no reason for that. Give me one reason why that document shouldn't be shown to everyone. And I don't mean the fraudulent ones that we've seen on the Internet that they put out, that their own press secretary brags that they put out there for the doubters and the disbelievers that they started calling birthers. They had to give us a name. No, we're truth seekers. And we are the rightful people, we're the rightful owners of this country, despite the reptilian banking system, basically from Europe, that wants to control us. Under God's laws, under God's gifts of life, and under the laws of the creation, we have a right to be here, and we have a right to determine our own fate and our own quality of life. Days of slavery are over, Drew. I'm telling you. Now,
well, they're supposed to be, but in all honesty, we're slaves. I mean,
they want us to think we are.
We really are. I mean, I have this argument, just discussion, argument, whatever you want to call it.
Disquisition.
I have this all the time. And people look at me like, oh, I'm not a slave. I says, yes, you are. You're a slave to the man-made society that you've allowed to happen in America. Stop and think about it. And let's talk about a slave, being a slave on a plantation. When you're a slave on a plantation, you have to ask the master to do anything other than what you're supposed to do. Let's say work. Okay, you work in the cotton field, you work in the sugar field, you work in the cotton gin, you work in a sugar gin, or maybe you work on a tomato field because your wife is working over on the okra field, and it's a 500,000 acres, and your mother and your father are with you as slaves. You work in one section, your dad works in another section. Maybe your dad works over in the watermelon fields, making sure the melons and the weeds are getting taken care of, and you're working over in the cotton fields, making sure that there's no boll weevils grabbing a hold of the cotton as it's growing, and your wife's over in the okra fields, making sure the okra's coming up properly, and your mother is over at the tomato fields, making sure that they get rid of all the worms that are growing, but then everybody's working in the fields, and you get up in the morning, you go to work, the master, the slave master, he brings your food out to you, your water throughout the day, you get bit by a snake or a spider, or you step on a hoe, well, the slave master calls the doctor and brings the doctor in, takes care of you. Maybe you need some rest, so he sends you back into the barn or to the slave quarters where you sit down, and he's got television set up for you, and you get a little mind about why you heal yourself. Well, that may have gone on if there'd been televisions, obviously, 150 years ago. But in today's society, we have television. Today, you're a slave because you can't do anything. You go to work. When you go to work, you get in your car, a car you do not own. It's registered to the state. You have to have insurance that you pay for. 150 years ago, the slave master paid it all. Today, you're a slave because you have a driver's license, registration, proof of insurance, and you try to travel on the highway where you have a right to travel across America, and some police officer sees that you haven't got a tag on your car, he's going to pull you over. If you're going a little bit too fast, this police officer, you're going to make some revenue here for the judge. He pulls you over, and you don't have your insurance papers or whatever. He takes the car away from you, whether you've got the insurance or not, and he has a tow truck come get it because you haven't got it in your possession. So you see where the slave ownership is.
Well, Drew, I agree with all that, but what I'm saying is the days of slavery are over.
I disagree because
you've just traded
all the benefits that the slave owner gave you 150 years ago to pieces of paper today. You're a slave to what's going
Drew,
on to the government.
Drew, let me finish making my statement, please. Okay? It is my show.
I understand that, but I don't see the difference between what you think a slave 150 years ago that
Drew,
didn't have to have any papers.
Drew, think outside.
Go ahead. I'm listening.
Think outside the box for a moment. Okay?
Nobody wants to think outside the box when I bring this argument up. Go ahead.
I'm familiar with this.
Go ahead, please.
I don't disagree with what you're saying. I'm trying to make a statement outside the box. The days of slavery are over. The moment one recognizes the game that you just described, what would be the reason for accepting that as the only outcome, the only possibility of being here on this planet? The purpose of life is to be enslaved? Is that, from what you know about God's word, is that the reason why God created us? So I'm making a statement, I'm making an affirmation that the days of slavery are over because these scumbag criminals, these crooks, organized crime figures, mafiosos, mob bosses, and terrorists, and murderers, and psychopaths are going to fall. They're going to fall. And the more people that stand up to the tyranny that they mete out to us, the better chance that that's going to happen sooner than later. I'm just making an affirmation here. I understand the game. I understand that it's designed to extort money from us, to blackmail us constantly from the moment we start breathing until we stop breathing. And they're still stealing from us after we're gone. I know all that. How much longer are people actually going to put up with this, do you think? Now that I've had a chance to make my point, do you see what I'm saying here?
We're still slaves. And what you're saying is when you're looking at the idea that it's over, there's not enough Americans and not enough people on this planet that are looking at it in the same venue. They're not seeing that they're slaves because they're being paid off with ball games and the television set. They don't realize they're slaves. The slavery issue is, yes, people are waking up, Don, but not enough. The slave issue is here. It's not over. It may be the fight is at the tip of the iceberg. But when it does come to over, that's when everybody, just like in 1967, walks out there with their draft cards, all the men, that is, the boys, the girls didn't have draft cards, but the men walked out there and started burning their draft cards across America at universities. Prime example, we can't let the slaves do that. Let's send in the National Guard, Kent University, boom, and four people died. Four kids died, unarmed kids, 19, 20, 21 years old, four kids. They were slaves to society, but they had the guts to stand up and say, I'm going to burn my draft card. I'm not going to Vietnam.
Yeah. Drew, was there any difference between the people that originally brought slaves to America and the ones that run the banks or the pharmaceutical companies or the oil companies? Any difference?
we didn't have those companies back in the days that the slaves came to America. But no, not comparing those slave owners then and the slave owners today. There's not a difference.
Who are the people who financed those things? It's the same
bankers.
Same people.
Bankers, and they financed the slaves back 200 years ago. They financed the slaves today. The bankers financed the slave, regardless of what era you go back to, except unless you go back to the days of Genghis Khan or the days of Alexander the Great. A lot of people think, well, Alexander the Great. Well, Alexander was not great. He was another man that was more or less a tyrant in the sense that he was trying to expand Macedonia, and he did. He conquered the known world. He was a great genius. But in those days, the emperor led the fight. Today, the emperor sits in Washington, D.C., and sends your daughters and your sons out.
Yes.
Because you're slaves.
Well, we agree on that premise. I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying. I'm making
I realize you're not disagreeing.
A futuristic affirmation that as long as one holds on to that mindset, yes, historically you're correct. As long as we accept that as our lot, then we will stay there. We will remain there. And that's what you're witnessing when you talk about homes being foreclosed, people being thrown out on the streets, everybody losing their jobs. They can't get food. They can't get clean water. They can't get medical care. Can't get anything.
And also one issue that a lot of people are just overlooking, and that is just about every major city in America once a week has a foreclosure auction on automobiles. In today's society, if you don't live in a city that's got a good form of public transportation, okay, like Little Rock, for instance, you lose your car, you better be able to have a job that you're close enough to walk to, or you're going to go buy another car. And there's going to be some other finance bank down there that says, oh, well, okay, ABC Bank foreclosed on this car for you. And, well, I've got to find another car. I've got to go back and forth to work. All right, well, you've got to prepay your payments 3 months in advance, and your interest rate is now 14%, but it's financed outside the state of Arkansas because the state of Arkansas has a law that you can't we can't finance a car for more than 2% above prime. Prime is 3.8 right now. That means you can't you go and buy a car in the state of Arkansas, the car lot can't regardless whether it's a used or new, they can't charge more than 5.78. State law, 2% above prime. And, and this predatory lending out there is what's going on, which is against the law. But it's a contract. It's a contract, Uniform Commercial Code. And if you sign the dotted line that specifically says you're going to be financing this through a banking lender, not necessarily a bank, it could be just a lender, and the lending company is located in Starkville, Mississippi. The interest rate in Starkville, Mississippi is 21%. Well, that's how they get away with it, and that's what happened in Arkansas about 20 years ago when they did away with privately owned banks in Arkansas. Big corporate banks from other states were just licking their chops to get into Arkansas because all the banks here were independently owned by groups of Arkansas people or groups of men and women that are around the United States, but it was owned in – they didn't have any branch banks outside the state. There was a lot of real capital money in these banks. And somewhere around 1989, 1991 – the legislature allowed the fence to go down on the plantation in Arkansas, and banks from around the country, like Regions, for instance, or Bank of America, or Wells Fargo, or Mellon, they came diddy-bopping in here like wolves. state of Arkansas. And now you have to look high and low. There are still some privately owned banks in this state owned by millionaires. Well, not, I shouldn't say millionaires. I should say billionaires, such as the Walton family or the Stevens family or the Hunt family. And they own these banks so they can loan money to their businesses. And I mean that very, very, very truthfully. They own these banks so they can loan money to their whatever at a low interest rate, and they utilize the slave money that puts their money in that bank for safekeeping. And it goes back to the slave issue. Instead of being a slave on a plantation where the plantation owner made sure the food was put on the table three times a day and made sure the doctor came when you got hurt or the dentist came when you got hurt, made sure that you had fruits and vegetables when they were in season. Instead of him taking the responsibility of you and your medical care and making sure the roof over your slave quarters was maintained and your bedding was washed and cleaned and kept, he said, well, why should I do this? I can still have you as a slave. You own your own house, but you pay for your own food. You do that from your – people just don't realize that there is not much difference between being the slave of today versus the slave of 1850. But they are waking up. I agree with you on Don. They are waking up. And what's going to happen? What's really going to happen? When the light bulb explodes on these slaves of modern history, they're going to start acting just like the French did in 1789. And they're going to say there's not a hell of a difference between the guy that works at City Hall behind a computer that takes my money for the police because the police officer wrote me a ticket. And the guy that sits there at City Hall that is the mayor of the town that's drawing a $600,000 a year salary, and I'm out here slaving away at $48,000 a year.
Yeah, that's why I made the statement I made before. Is the moment that one wakes up to that, it's a different reality. You don't have to comply with that which you know is fraudulent. You see, that word tract, that usually covers an area. It's in the case of a piece of paper, a document, a tract is that which is contained on that paper. The word con added to the front of it says it all.
Who is the comedian that I don't know if he still, I think he still does. He goes from around colleges two or three times a year. At the
end you meant George Carlin?
Huh?
George Carlin, are you speaking about?
No, I know George Carlin.
He passed away.
This is George Carlin didn't travel. He went around to universities as well, but he didn't smash food and vegetables on the stage.
Oh, well, that was Bruce Baby Man. Oh, no, Gallagher.
Gallagher, yeah.
Bruce Baby Man.
Gallagher, he did I don't know. It's been over 10 years, but I'm sure he still uses that platform because I went and witnessed at LSU a Gallagher performance. I didn't sit on the front stage because I knew about the watermelon. I sat about two-thirds of the way back to a really good location. And anyway, to make a long story short, he's up there and he does the show on Congress, and Contract. And he has everybody rolling in the floor with just the terminology of con. And that's basically what's happened in America. We have forgotten the words and definitions of what our founding fathers set up. We got con and we got grass, and it was like it's in your face. We're going to create a con on you, and we're going to call it the con in the grass. And it amazes me that people, even though we sat there and laughed if he hit the tomato and splashed tomato for 60 feet out, in that little performance, that people just didn't get the whole story of what he was saying. And George Carlin is another example. He gets on the stage, and when he was alive, and God bless his soul, I mean, the guy finally realized that there is a God now. He can't say that there isn't, because that's where he's at. I hope and pray that his soul was saved, because he was a good entertainer, and he was an honest man.
Well, he was speaking, I think, the way he did, the way he presented the whole concept. He was criticizing organized religion. Actually, he spoke as one who was part of the congregation.
The congregation.
So,
George was on point the last year. He was he died even planning had three concerts coming up within 90 days of his death. So it was, his death was totally unexpected to him and to his doctor and other friends. But and he's sorely missed, because we don't have any comics out there that's got the guts to come up and stand up against the Oprah Winfreys and the Obamas and the Clintons and the McCains in the Kennedy clan anymore. It amazes me that out of the mouths of comics come truth. You heard the song "The Vatican Rag," did you not?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
And that was done by Tom Lehrer in 1963. And right in your face, ladies and gentlemen, he got out there and was talking about how the Catholics were attempting to take over the world. Amazing that all this goes back, and we go back and we look at other intellectuals. We look at Sam Clemens, a.k.a. Mark Twain. We look at... well, who was it in the 30s? I can't remember his name. I went totally blank. Sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. He died with Will Rogers.
Well, I was going to say, you know, Carlin was sort of like a Will Rogers.
He was in their face every day. The man was right in their face, but he was part of the system in such a way that he really believed that the Democratic Party was the savior of the nation, and it wasn't. And that was one of the things that I really fought Will Rogers on, really fought him, because he did. He could not see that the political machinery of both the Republicrats and the Democrats in the 1930s was just as bad as they are today, and maybe even worse then.
Well, they were a creation of that Wall Street and City of London banking cartel.
And he did not see that City of London banking cartel, or maybe he did, but he accepted it and was part of it. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, Drew, you mentioned the Vatican Rag. I've got it set up if you want to listen to it. It's not very long.
If you don't want to play it, I'll play it.
No, I'll play
it up too.
I'll play it. I got the high definition version of it on my end. So,
well, you know, us poor boys out here, we just get to listen to it.
Yeah, this is Tom Lehrer and the Vatican Rag. Coming your way.
First you get down on your knees, fiddle with your rosaries, bow your head with great respect and genuflect, genuflect, genuflex. Make do whatever steps you want if you have cleared them with the pontiff.
Now, this is supposed to be the Vatican Rag, and this says security rag.
Well, that was, yeah, that's the Vatican, right.
That's it. Okay, well, I'll continue.
Everybody say his own Kyrie liaison, doing the Vatican right. Get in line in that processional, step into that small confessional. They're the guy who's got religion. I'll tell you if your sin's original. If it is, try playing it safer. Drink the wine and chew the wafer. 2, 4, 6, 8. Time to transubstantiate. So get down upon your knees, fiddle with your rosaries. Bow your head with great respect and genuflect. Make a cross on your abdomen when in Rome, do like a Roman. Ave Maria, gee, it's good to see you. Getting ecstatic and sort of dramatic and doing the Vatican right.
1963, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, and he was called Fade, and that song came out just before Kennedy's assassination.
Yeah, you know, I'm reading above the page, and it says Security Rag, and I said, wait a minute, that sounds like the Vatican Rag. Well, somebody put that title up there because it reminded them of that song.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really, the reason.
Let's see, what's today? What's the date? Today's the 6th. Yeah, it's the 6th. Today's the 6th. So it would have been on the 3rd. On my news and views for the 3rd, I have the link. Yeah, all right, John, I'll do that. John, one of Windtalker's station owners says, why don't you put it on the news and views again tomorrow? Earlier this week on one of my news and views pages, I had the link to the Vatican Rag so you could click on it for yourself and watch it at your own leisure, from your own computer.
Well, you now have it again. So.
Oh, I have the link from YouTube posted on the news and views for the Vatican Rag, and I sent it out, and I had a lot of responses coming in. Doug in Northern Ireland comes in and he says, "No, it wasn't on the 3rd or the 2nd." So I know I've got it out there, so I'll make sure it goes on my news and views again tomorrow. But ladies and gentlemen, he's a comic. And what's his name again?
Tom Lehrer.
Tom Lehrer.
Yes, Lehrer.
You could take the 160 video clips that you can find at the library, believe it or not, of all places. They have DVDs of this guy back in 63 and 64. And you'll roll on the floor, but he's not a stand-up comic in the sense of standing up with a microphone in front of him. He sits at a piano and he puts all of his comedy routine from the form of songs. And somebody, I guess his publicist, had enough foresight to realize how good they were, because he was very popular in 63 in the major cities in the United States. And they actually filmed everything, put everything on celluloid, and that celluloid has been converted to DVDs and posted in libraries around America. So you have the opportunity today to witness the fact that it may be 2010, but it's still 1963. Or 1935, or 1933, or 1916, or 1900. People have to stand up again and understand. The United States is a great nation. We have not fulfilled our due diligence in protecting what our forefathers gave us. And like Benjamin Franklin said, in late June of 1789, we have given you a republic if you can hold on to it.
You know, Drew, in regard to the comment that you made about the foreclosures, has anyone determined on a percentage basis as to how many of those homes are being foreclosed due to rather dubious financial maneuvers.
No, but maybe. I got a real estate broker in Redondo Beach, California, who is a former United States Marine. He happens to be a friend of mine. Now, he wasn't one of my troops. He just happened to be a friend of mine living in an apartment complex. I was an active duty Marine in Huntington Beach and living in an apartment complex about 36 miles from the base. I was about 8 miles above where I should be in the first place. But he had served in the Corps and just happened to live in the same complex. And I introduced him to one of my troops' mothers, and Kimbo, Mrs. Kimbo was her name. She was a mortgage escrow agent, and he befriended her, and then he later moved into Redondo Beach where she was from. And he was talking to me last week just on this same subject, that we need to get out here and do an investigation of the fraud that's going on in these foreclosures. And I said, you know, hey, man, Mike, that's great. I don't know of anybody that can do it. You're 64 years old. You're semi-retired. This is right up your alley. Now, he's got his own. He now holds the same job that Mrs. Kimbo had, Lee Kimbo. And my respect for Lee is you cannot tear it down. I can close my eyes and remember this lady and the business that she was in. And I wished I had the foresight to do what she was doing, because all she did was to hold the money as a third-party non-interested person in the purchase.
As an the real definition escrow. Of what an escrow agent is supposed to be.
Exactly.
You know, escrow, the word escrow means to steal or to scam.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's what it means. But see, the escrow agent is supposed to hold good faith money on. And,
exactly. And, well, that was what she did. And she had, you know, $2-4 million in her escrow account. She couldn't make any interest on it, but the closing of the mortgage, she would go to the title company as the escrow holder, and she was paid $200-500 per closing. She never had to sell a house. She didn't have to show property. She just was the middle person.
Yeah.
In the contract basis, to make sure that these people would put this money up, and if they didn't fulfill the contract on the purchase of the property, she dispersed that money to the proper places, unless it was some legal remedy to give the money back to the original owner. I don't want to get into the whys and the wheres, but Mike is out there, and he's been looking at this over the last 5 years. And what bothers him is, and how he got to this point, is he went out to a subdivision in East L.A. where he said this is like from downtown L.A. This is like 20 miles. And he said, Drew, this subdivision was put together 5 years ago, and the houses in there sold, cheapest house in there sold for $500,000. And there were like 300 homes. I went out there to investigate and just to ask them a question, because I was the escrow officer holding about 20% of the mortgages as those in the purchase sale of those homes. And I drove right by where this subdivision was supposed to be, and didn't even realize I'd driven by it. And I said, "Well, how do you miss a subdivision when you're driving down interstate?" He says, "They bulldozed the entire subdivision because they had all been foreclosed on." And when I looked into it, the 32 houses that hadn't been foreclosed on, the banks bought them back and moved the people out of those homes so they could bulldoze the entire subdivision and put a 8-foot fence around an 8-foot fence around 10,000 acres. And it's not nothing but bramble bushes.
Yeah, so nobody could see what was actually going on.
I'm thinking, you know, the bank has that much money to, instead of putting people into these homes, they've got the money to pay for a demolition crew to come in and tear down several hundred homes?
Well, they did that in Cleveland. They tore down 2,000 homes, and a couple of people stood up to Deutsche Bank and won their cases. There was an honest judge that couldn't look anybody in the eye and lie about what had occurred.
And because of him, it's mushroomed around the United States, believe it or not, because there are now other judges. And I'm not saying the judges are totally honest or and should not be held accountable, but there are a few judges out there that are doing the same thing.
Yeah. Now,
because the right questions are being asked.
Yeah. See, when these properties are foreclosed and let's say they're not torn down, the paperwork is turned over to somebody and it generates a whole new batch of fictitious derivatives and hedge funds as if they own this. And what was going on in these houses that we're talking about, in these neighborhoods being foreclosed and torn down, is outright criminality, outright thievery that's occurring. Because if you could see the number of transactions that were written on just one single property, you say, how could this be? How could this occur? But everybody's getting a piece of the action. And they end up driving the smaller title companies out of business. They're trying to consolidate all the title companies into one title company. And, you know, I've had many title agents contact me about helping them get the message out as to what's actually going on. These are independents that have been in this business since they went into business. And they're finding that this corruption is destroying what otherwise would be an honest business. And they get money for the attorneys and the surveyors and all the inspectors that they have to bring in
That's what the job of the escrow holder that Lee Kimbo did in California. She made sure that the inspection properties would come in. The inspectors came in and looked at the properties. The title company was informed of what was going on in between, and the state was being informed, and all the paperwork was going through her office. So she made sure the paperwork was actually done and done properly. They've gotten away from those people. Now, in California, they haven't, but they've gotten away from the independent escrow holders in 40 of the 50 states. And as you said, they're trying to get rid of the independents out there and consolidate it down. It rhymes directly with I had it on my top of my mind. It's
were you going to say Section 8?
Yeah, tell me. What was that name? Remember that there was a movie about it, the Christmas thing where what's his face had the
It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, It's a Wonderful Life, and he stood up against the big banker. Savings and Loan. Thank you, Larissa.
George Bailey stood up against Lionel Barrymore.
Right.
The evil guy.
The evil banker, and he was the epitome of all the big bankers out there. Okay, it's too early. It's too early to think about some of these. But the savings and loans—they did away with the savings and loans in the late '80s because the savings and loans was actually holding back the Lionel Barrymores and the big bankers out there and keeping them from really taking control. Now you have—if you want to borrow money to buy a home, you only have one place to go. the corrupt banking system.
Yeah, if you're fortunate, you might find a credit union, you know, that's owned by the members and so operates a little bit differently. But, you know, a bank robber is going to go wherever there's money to steal money. So they'll concoct. There's that word con again. They'll concoct any device, any means to hoodwink the public. And then they're doing all this behind the scenes. All of it is illegal, including the derivatives and the hedge funds. The securitization of public property and the conversion of public assets into private hands is what it's about. It's
and they
totally
sit there in the background. They, ladies and gentlemen, are these controlled elitists, Nazis, like Nazi Pelosi, and fascists, like fascist Gore, or downright socialists, like the Clintons. And they want you to eat cake. They flaunt themselves out in front of you. Like, you take a good hard look, ladies and gentlemen. In the last 45 years, William Jefferson Clinton never, I repeat, never held a job where he worked for somebody other than a government agency that paid his Social Security. He's never worked for anything but government service jobs. And yet, he is a multi-millionaire. Do you not see there's something wrong with this picture?
Well, did he ever put MENA Airport on his resume?
I think he's got it down there somewhere. And
because that's where he made his initial big money.
Well, yeah, and who was his banker?
The Madison
Herbert Walker Bush.
Well, you had that Madison Guarantee and Loan. You remember that case?
I remember that. The first time that I physically was in the presence of William Jefferson Clinton was the day Madison Guarantee did open their doors up over on Main Street, and I had a real estate license for only about 8 months, and my broker, a record company, just wanted us all to go over and munch on their dirt. So I went over to see what it was all about. And believe it or not, there was a lot of white noses all over the place. I just had to get up and walk out. And ladies and gentlemen, if you don't know what white noses is, we're talking about white powder and a little sprinkle on something, and they were sniffing it. But I left about 3 or 4 minutes. As a matter of fact, as I was driving out of the parking lot, the limousine carrying William Jefferson Clinton, governor, drove up, and the rest of you just have no clue back in 1987 of the criminal cabal of the Clinton family at that time. Hillary never went anywhere with this guy. She never went anywhere, but and you hear some of the stories about Clinton going off into a back room. He didn't go anywhere where he didn't go into a back room with some female. It was blatant. It was sickening. But that shows you the immorality of the American people that are enamored by some personality. And it blows me away that people will sit down and allow a homosexual or an adulterer to get into the highest office of this land, or a major murderer, liar, thief. And that's what we've had since Reagan died and since Reagan left office. We haven't had an honest man sitting in the White House. And somewhere along the line, Ronald Reagan, I think the day after he got shot, somebody came to his room there in the hospital and whispered in his ear, because from that day forward, Ronald Reagan was a different man. all you have to do is just look at his actions before and after. And it's like night and day, Don. It's like night and day.
Yeah. And isn't it amazing how many of the alleged parents, parents and grandparents of these people died early deaths? Bill Clinton's alleged father, returning from a shoe convention in Chicago, dies on a Missouri highway in a thunderstorm. And, not many are buying that story, but that's the official story of how his father died. There are others that see the direct link to the Rockefellers.
Well, the payoff was to his mother for her to keep her mouth shut. Okay, her son would become the governor, and then they moved him on. And you're right, the lineage is there. And people, if you think you don't think they don't throw this in your face, you look at the wedding of Chelsea Clinton here. That was in your face. You could look at the face of Chelsea Clinton. There's some resemblance of Chelsea Clinton to her mother, but I guarantee you, I got a picture of a man.
Webb Hubble.
Webb Hubble. That Chelsea Clinton looks. I mean, you talking about spitting image of his family? She looks like she came right out. She was adopted out of that family.
So I threw the name out there ahead of you.
That's all right. I don't mind.
Just
I mean,
so we're on the same page there. You see,
right? We are. And there's a boy running around up here in Fayetteville, Arkansas. I don't know if he's in Fayetteville anymore because he's now graduated from the University of Fayetteville. That is the spitting image of a very tanned William Jefferson Clinton. And when I say very tanned, I think his mother is related to what's her name?
Give me a hint.
the billionaire lady that's on top, Oprah Winfrey.
Oh, you think her mother's related to Oprah? Really?
Well, no, I'm just it was a rumor that this guy's mother should be Oprah Winfrey's daughter.
Oh, I see.
Okay.
Oh.
And her here's a very tanned William Jefferson Clinton, red haired, very very tanned boy that looks just like William Jefferson Clinton, only he is not of the full white race. Let's put it that way.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Well,
and I don't know. The last I heard, it was kind of hard pressed to even get pictures of this kid. But his mother was the Channel 7 news anchor. And then she was moved when William Jefferson Clinton became the president. She took she got a job in Washington D.C. as a writer analyst, with in a pay raise of about five times what she was making here in Arkansas. That's pretty good for a girl that just graduates out of Shorter College, which is a small black community college here in Little Rock. Here in Little Rock, that's lost its accreditation as a college two or three times since 1990.
Hmm. Now, shifting gears just a little bit, we're out of time really, but I want to mention briefly this trip to Spain that the short-legged Mac mommy made. She booked 60 rooms. 60.
Well, she started off with 32, then she's up to 60.
Yeah, that's what, 120 lobsters a day.
Well, you have to understand, reptilians don't eat like you and I. You might want to point out that two of those rooms are the presidential suites on the top floor.
Okay. So an extra 58 rooms.
Well, Colorado Al made a comment today on my show after Bob Chapman said that what can she do in 60 rooms that she can't do in one? I said, well, her daughter is in one presidential suite on the top floor at one end of the hallway, and she's in the other one. So the daughter's down there playing with the young kids that are brought in for her entertainment. And then what's the short-legged Mac Daddy's wife doing? Who knows? But the short-legged Mac Daddy decided that, I got the taxpayer's money out there. I think I'll go to Chicago and have birthday cake with Oprah and Wright. And Jeremiah Wright and all my little cronies over there. I don't know all the people that showed up in Chicago, but it was very well orchestrated and very secretly planned. Then he showed up. But what's really funny about this, they had their little party yesterday. Remember the woman that broke through, that was the gate crasher there at the presidential dinner in Washington?
I remember the event. I don't remember her name, but yes.
Well, she happened to show up at the Oprah Winfrey taping of the Oprah Winfrey The View yesterday. And she had a yelling and screaming argument with Oprah Winfrey after the show was over, after The View was over. I don't know if it was recorded or whatever. But here's this great cashier, happens to be in Chicago at the same time Obama is. Now this is kind of funny. Here's a gate trasher from Washington D.C. that shows up in Chicago on the same day that the short-legged Mac Daddy is, and she has no family in Chicago. How in the heck did she get to Chicago?
It sounds very staged, doesn't it?
So, and who all showed up at the birthday party last night? From what I've been told, there were about 120 guests, but there hasn't been an itinerary issued of what time the party started, other than the fact that Jeremiah Wright and Oprah Winfrey were there. And I'm thinking to myself, there's something wrong with this picture. If I'm happily married, my wife's not going to take a vacation when my 49th birthday is going to come up.
The day before my birthday, yeah.
You know?
Well, I have to scratch that order, a room service, and change it to 240. I didn't realize that there were 120 people.
Yeah.
The lobster, I mean, you know.
Right. And there's only 98 rooms in the hotel.
One for lunch, one for dinner.
Well, and what's for breakfast?
Lobster cakes.
Ah, that's good. I can go for that. How about... What about lobster? What's lobster quiche?
Yeah.
You know how many ways can you serve? Yeah, it's one of those times you want to be one of those yellow lobsters where you don't have to worry about
lobster bisque.
Lobster bisque. Yeah.
Well, you know this.
Get out of here, I guess.
This thing in Spain reeks of some kind of financial shenanigans to me. That's the only reason they would be there. Why would you go on such a venture?
In Spain, of all places. When has the First Lady of the United States gone to Spain and camped out with a planned itinerary for 2 weeks? You know?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's an easy way to funnel money in and out. I don't know.
But there's
hardly any news media. Do you know that the news media in Spain hardly exists? And the European newspapers aren't like Americans. They're not bought off. So the newspapers from around Europe have been converging on Spain because they didn't even know Michelle Obama was coming there until 2 days before. And there was no way that they could find a hotel room within 100 miles.
Well, I have to.
We were taking up most of them because of the Marine Security Guard detachment that came with us.
I have a story to tell you about that trip, but it'll have to wait
for
another time. Yeah. Anyway, in closing out the show, Drew, We've been hearing reports that they can't find oil anywhere. Everybody's saying that the Gulf of Mexico oil disaster appears to be resolved. And that
as long
water...
as you're not a photo reconnaissance photographer for the Navy.
Exactly.
Or the Marine Corps or the Air Force, because they've been looking at the photo reconnaissance photographs from outer space, 22,500 miles up, and they're seeing massive oil in the Gulf.
Yes, an area exceeding 12,000 square miles.
Mm-hmm. And these idiots in Washington are making statements like, oh, well, it's okay to eat the fish out of the Gulf now. We can't find any oil down there, and we've been testing the shrimp and the oysters and everything else, and we can't find anything. But I'm thinking, no, I got to get in touch with somebody. So I called a buddy of mine, of all places, customs. Most people don't understand customs. Customs makes sure anything that's brought into the United States, somebody in customs knows what's going on. There's an awful lot of seafood, ladies and gentlemen, coming in from the Brazil, Southeast Asia, over 50 times above normal, being shipped into the United States through the Gulf ports. So you think about, well, and they're putting it off as being brought in by the shrimpers of Louisiana. The shrimpers of Louisiana haven't gone out to sea for over 30 days. They don't have any seafood. They can't catch any seafood.
Yeah. Actually, you'd have to say over 90 days, really, you know, to catch any.
No, I'm talking, well, see, there's been a few of them that made it out over 30 days ago, but what they did is, It took them a week to go to the northern port of Mexico and shrimp that 12-mile area of the Gulf just north of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't understand Mexico's got a large beachfront property in the Gulf of Mexico, and that's where the Louisiana shrimpers were doing. But when the shrimpers got back and they sold their catch, it wasn't worth them going that far for the cost and the fact that they were out there with a work crew, because they still have to pay their crew on the daily wage, whether they catch anything or not.
Yeah. Well, you know, this whole picture, Drew, if you take into account that this is just happening now, it's still happening, really. I mean, they're lying to us about it, but it's something that's just occurred in recent times. You go all the way back to 1989. And the Exxon spill up there in Alaska, that is still an issue up there. That's not cleaned up. They haven't totally cleaned that up.
Nope.
So consider that 21 years later, that's still going on. They're underplaying what has occurred in the Gulf of Mexico. And the amount of Corexit 9500 that they've sprayed into the water and pumped into the water and dumped into the water is going to have long-standing consequences. Mark my words.
Well, I'll tell you this much. Because of the Valdez accident, because of the Gulf of Mexico accident, the Chinese are treating their oil spill quite differently. And they're not afraid. The Chinese are not afraid to tell you that they've already had one death where one of their Chinese cleaners fell into the oil and died within a few minutes because he couldn't swim in the oil. And the Chinese have admitted that it's a severe threat to the sea life and the fishery industry off the Chinese coast, where they're having an environmental crisis
mm-hmm.
because of an oil spill. And they readily admit right up front that one cleanup worker has drowned because he was coated so thickly with the crude. And the Greenpeace people are out there in force.
Mm-hmm.
And the oil spill the oil is like it's half solid and half liquid. So it's like a sticky asphalt, and if you fall into it, you can't swim in it. You're going to
sink. Yeah, it's a very different from, you know, this other situation and other spills. Yeah. Well, Drew, listen, we're out of time. I hate to cut you off here, but we got to close out the show.
I appreciate the opportunity to talk to people, and I'd like to leave the audience around the world on Wind Talkers' blog talk and on BBS Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, do your own diligence and research. You don't have to listen to me or Don or anybody. If you will do your own diligence, just take what we bring to you and then expand on it. And you're not going to walk away ashamed that when you go to talk about what you're talking about because you've got the evidence to back it up. Thank you, Don.
You're welcome. Thanks for being on the show, and I look forward to being on your show next Monday, a Marines Disquisition on Wind Talkers and Blog Talk Radio. You have a great night and a great weekend coming up.
I'm going to try to take a vacation this weekend. Don't know if I can or not, but I'm going to try.
All right. Right, folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and our special guest, Drew Malone Raines III. Be sure to visit his website at amd.elequity.com. And his show is heard, depending on where you are in the world, it's heard Tuesday through Sunday, or should I say Sunday through Friday.
Sunday through Saturday around the world.
And on Saturday. Saturday's your Sabbath day, though. So,
no, I see it. It's not my Sabbath day because I'm not in Australia or New Zealand.
At that time, yeah.
At that time. The show plays from Tuesday through Saturday from my flagship station off of Highway 8 in New Zealand and the other flagship stations in Southeast Asia. From Monday through Friday, I'm played at 2,100 hours from my flagship station out of the northern area of Ireland, which is the six counties, and the North Island of Scotland. Then if you could progress over to Simmerfold, the Crimean, it becomes Tuesday morning, so from Tuesday morning until Saturday morning. So the largest portion of Wind Talkers are about 8 hours ahead of me. Well, 8 hours ahead of me means it's midnight or the next day.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, we got to say goodnight, Drew. Thanks for clearing that up.
Did I clear that up? I'm good. I've got to go find out how I did that.
You either cleared it up or compounded the situation. Thanks. Special thanks to Wind Talkers Radio Network and blogtalkradio.com. Also want to thank Seth Hendrick and Don Newsom on the sound, Don and Doug Newsom, for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Do us a favor and help cover bandwidth costs if you could. Make sure you subscribe to the archives for Evident Footprints. It's an annual subscription that entitles you to all the shows on bbsradio.com. So if you're working during the time of your favorite show, you can always go back and get a hold of the archives. They're downloadable or listenable right there on the website. In the meantime, I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.